Good morning to most, good afternoon to others, and good evening to the viewing audience across the pond. My name is Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. If you are a returning listener or subscriber, welcome back! So glad to have you here. If you're a new listener to the show, welcome. Join us. If you do enjoy what you're seeing, and make sure you like and subscribe on your way out. It's a passive gesture that goes a very long way. I want to send a big thank you out to the patrons that joined us for a bit of an intense movie night, a departure from what we've been doing of late, of kind of more fun, silly movies. We watched kind of an intense documentary, Let It Fall, about the LA riots and the history that preceded the riots, 82 to 92. Thank you again, Jerry Salmon, for setting that up. Thank you, M. Toussaint, for showing up. And where were you, Pascal?
We're coming for you.
You know it. Just kidding. It's okay. But we will be doing a show on the riots with some people that were there next week, next Thursday. So I'm excited about that. Also, I want to give a friendly reminder. Do you have June 8th reserved on your calendar? I hope you do, because June 8th will be in DC. Beyond the Black Jacobin, C.L.R. James and the Struggle for Socialism in America. Keynote speakers, Adolph Reed, the Pascal Robert, Daniel Tutt, What? Vanessa Willis. C. Derek Varn, as NT calls him, my stunt double, Billy Blunton. And I'll be there. Doing what? I don't know. But wherever you are listening or watching the show, there are links in the description to get tickets to the event. And if you cannot make it out and still want to see it, there's a link to tickets for the live stream as well. So that's going to be exciting. It's, oof, God, what, 6 weeks away? Love the live shows. And there's even more live stuff that we're planning also for later, early in the fall, I guess we can say. But today we are here to talk about the struggle to be gay in Mexico, for example, which is the title of the book that our guest wrote. Our guest today, Roger Lancaster, has written a book that provides an in-depth examination of the complexities of gay identity and experiences in Mexican society. Not just an identitarian view, but an all-important class analysis as well. The book is an exploration of how individuals navigate and negotiate their sexual orientation in a cultural context where traditional values, norms, and religious beliefs often clash with modern attitudes towards sexuality and LGBTQ plus rights. Through a blend of personal narratives and sociological and analysis and cultural critique, Lancaster offers a nuanced perspective on the struggles and triumphs of being gay in Mexico and what it means for the rest of the world. From the book, Struggle to Be Gay in Mexico, for example. If I have made my mark, the reader will see that gayness as the concept actually circulates in everyday life among ordinary people is in no small part an unfiltered desire, a frustrated wish, a receding referent, a capacious utopian longing for a better life that takes shape under definite material conditions and aims at a discernible horizon of happiness. This might sound something like Jose Munoz's inventive claims in Cruising Utopia, but perhaps it might be better to invert Munoz's assertions about an abstracted queerness, which he sees as the future utopian idea. Actually, the concept of queerness, which carries with it a stigma and social exclusion as the price of pleasure or love, is very much part of the lived here and now for most LGBT people who long to escape the estranged reality, or at least seek to reprieve from it. What people who work, worry, and wish generally aspire to is a gay future, that is to say, a happy, unfettered one. The reader will come to make out something of the class content of these very strivings in the following pages. Reflection on this, the class character of gay struggles, is largely absent in Munoz's book and other works that purport to delve into the utopian dimension of LGBT life. Occasional references to class notwithstanding, the nucleus of Munoz's utopia seems to be found in a curiously segregated social imagination, in ethnically homogeneous bars and clubs where participants, free at last of the white gaze, pose and model conjugated race, ethnic, sexual identities. It seems to me that this acknowledgement of what we do when we aspire to gayness, recognition of the primacy of the class condition of our evanescent scenes and flickering identities, neither closes off nor reduces or narrows the meanings of gay life, much less does it augure their retreat into ethnic enclaves. Rather, it opens up to wider solidarities and connects us with other struggles for dignity and a decent life. Or such, at any rate, is a sentimental gay socialist's utopian wish for us, that life might be more pleasant and more fulfilling, gayer, even after the music stops. This is a book about Mexican gay men, of course, but this is also a book about all of us. The reader will judge whether I have been reductive or synthetic. That again is from the book, The Struggle to Be Gay in Mexico, for example, by our guest, professor of anthropology and cultural studies at George Mason University. Please give a big TIR round of applause for Dr. Roger Lancaster. How are you?
Good afternoon, Jason. Good morning where you are.
Oh, thank you very much for that. People always forget that it's like really early for me. And it's not like I sleep. Thank you again for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciate it. I don't know if you know this, because I didn't even tell this to you when we were talking beforehand. You showed up on my radar because we have so many people in common. Right. And I've been wanting to get you on the show for a while now. So.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you, Jason.
A big thank you for taking the time to come out. The stars aligned. You wrote a book. You're doing press.
You know, publishers don't do publicity anymore. They used to be more active, and they've devolved all of that onto authors, and that's okay. You get to go around doing tours, doing podcasts and so on, and it's fun.
It's a different world post pandemic, right?
Indeed.
Pandemic came. It's like, oh, you guys had some. You could do all your speaking arrangements online. You know how the internet works. Now in the book, you come right out in the introduction. You talk about an awesome night you have in the Zona Rosa, Mexico City, or the Pink Zone, for our non-Spanish speaking viewers. But in your reflection of this raucous evening, where you're talking about the freedom you experience in Mexico, juxtaposed with what you see as a more conservative U.S., you're interrupted by a comrade that says pretty much, yeah, you're having a good time, but tomorrow these people have to return to a toil in a bit of a hidden life. He reminds you that many people have to go back to live with their parents and work these extremely low wage jobs. That friend then adds that most of them will succumb to family pressures to be married. That's how you start the book. Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about this, because I think you said it happens in like 2006.
I tee off with the scene from the Zona Rosa. I think it must have been, I don't remember what the date stamp was I put on it actually. But I've been paying visits off and on to the Zona Rosa since probably the 1984 or something like that, right?
Okay.
And so I've had like a number of years of visits and revisits and so on. By the time I'm writing about it here, I think it must be after 2006 and before 2012, sometime in that range. The Zona Rosa was gay Disneyland. I mean, it was it was an amazing spectacle that unfolded every evening. And so actually the spectacle started at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and just kept going until about 3 in the morning, right?
What would you compare it to? Would you compare it to like New York in the 70s or San Francisco in the 70s? Had you been to any of those places?
Yeah, I'm old enough that I was on the scene in Greenwich Village and San Francisco in the late 70s. Mexico City was incomparably bigger and more intense and livelier and and funner and I mean, you get, you know, with demographics and scale and size and all of that, you can have different effects. I think the Zona Rosa, I mean, there, you know, Mexican scholars have written about the Zona Rosa, of course, but it's sort of the epicenter of gay life in Mexico, and often a sharp contrast to the way most people live on a day-to-day basis.
Interesting. I mean, the way you describe it, I'm getting visions of, like, you know, what I remember as a much younger person, because I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area, when we would see scenes of, like, the Folsom Street Fair and stuff like that.
Right.
So I'm assuming it's like that, but more of a party atmosphere and probably a party everywhere.
The part, okay, so picture, you know, a major gay event, maybe not Gay Pride March, but close to that, right? In San Francisco. Okay. And then picture that happening every day in the Santa Rosa, right? So literally hundreds of people start to be seen on the streets and sidewalks by mid-afternoon, and then that accelerates. So by 7 or 8 p.m., you've got thousands of people on the streets. You've got thousands more in bars and antros, and it's just a very festive, lively, lively place.
I have to ask, and I'm not trying to be difficult by asking this question.
Sure.
So you started the book in 2006, but you still haven't been going there since the 80s. What was it like in the 80s? Because you said 84. So that's kind of in the middle of AIDS. I think we're calling it AIDS by 84, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I think we're calling it AIDS, but it's still the gay cancer.
Right. 1984. Write about this in a later chapter, right? Because of course part of the story I try to relate is how I came to understand the gay scene and how I came to see it and think about it. 1984, I was studying language in Cuernavaca, took a short bus ride. It's about an hour bus ride to Mexico City. Because I had read in a scandal sheet that the Zona Rosa was the center of gay life. And I thought, well, I want to see that because I couldn't find it in Cuernavaca. It was invisible to me. Right. I mean, I was struggling with language, of course, but even so, it was very discreet and not at all open. I went to the Zona Rosa and I wandered quaint streets named for European cities, because that's how the zona is set up, right? Looking in vain for signs of gay life. I could not find them. I wonder, all right, so like, you know, old timers tell me, geez, that's very strange, because by 1984, the gay scene was very lively in the zona. And then they say, I know what happened. You wandered into the zone. You happened to visit during one of the periodic limpiezas, cleanups, cleansings, crackdowns, because President de la Madrid's wife complained to the police that there were too many homosexuals in the sauna. And they responded by cleaning it, by shutting everything down and cleaning it up for a few weeks before it came back. So I had one, I had probably wandered in during a limpieza. So there's a little piece of the picture, right? I mean, gay life in Mexico up until the late neoliberal period had been punctuated by a series of openings and closures and openings and closures, and let it out and then put it back in the box. And even after the neoliberal period, I mean, one of the final chapter in the book talks about how authorities in Mexico City and Puebla subsequently shut down the scene in the Zona Rosa again on very careful not to be homophobic or anything.
Yeah.
On a completely different set of rationales. And of course, you know, what neoliberalism gives with one hand, it takes away with the other. And it took back a lot of the gains. And there's an interesting political side story there, right? I mean, I don't know. I can't piece it all together. One of the important parts is that the city and private developers were trying to develop an upscale residency scene on the edge of the zona, and they didn't want
gays.
They wanted gays, but like
the rich gays,
discreet, well-behaved, quiet,
the petite bourgeois business-owning gays.
That's what they want. They weren't opposed to a certain kind of scene. It was the fact, though, that there was class mixing, boisterousness in the streets, and all of that. And they really undertook to shut it down. And this, so the period that I write about, like early on, is when AMLO was governor of Mexico City, and it was like,
he's like, let it hang.
Very open.
He's a let it hang, literally and figuratively.
Let it hang. He had no interest in having a crackdown. When Ebrard became governor, same party, different personnel, that's when you saw crackdowns. You also saw some very serious problems with drug cartels all across
in the gay community, or just in general?
All across Mexico City, in nightclubs all across Mexico City. But there was one event that happened in one of the gay bars, and that became the pretext for shutting them all down. All right. And then that goes, you get 6 years of sort of repression. When Claudia Sheinbaum becomes governor,
our future president.
It opens up again, right? Mm. It opens up again, and they even christen, you know, the new Zona Rosa. There are posters everywhere. The new Zona Rosa.
I want to ask.
Sort of like the old one, really.
I'm very uncomfortable talking about the country in which I live in, because I won't get into where I live exactly and who lives around me, but that it could be uncomfortable. But that being said, I do want to ask this question about Claudia Sheinbaum.
Sure.
And what you're talking about, like opening up this area. Do you feel she's an extension of AMLO? Or do you think she's going to be a little more lefty liberal?
This is interesting. Okay. Like, all right. So AMLO, you know, first of all, let's talk about AMLO a little bit. AMLO did something that I would have not thought possible. I mean, he's a long campaigner. He's been in this since 1988, when he was a supporter of Cárdenas. Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas ran for president, and he may have been one of the young militants who urged Cárdenas to seize the National Palace when they all marched past it in protest over the stolen election. And like, that was a stolen election, purloined in plain view. Nobody had any ambiguity in their minds at all about what happened in that election. You know, for you to remember it, the computer crashed. They're announcing results. They're giving you the projection shows Cardenas winning. And then the computer crashes. And then a day later, when the computers come back up, shows a different result. De La Madrid, who was president, has admitted afterwards we didn't think we could turn over power to Cardenas. We feared instability, and so we just fed fake numbers into the system. All right, so AMLO campaigned all of those cycles in Cardenas's tradition, in the party that Cardenas helped form, the PDR. PRD? PRD, I'm sorry.
I know what you're talking about.
It was volatile. One wonders whether the 2006 election was also stolen. There are reasons to think so. There are reasons to be skeptical. It looks like a kind of a low intensity fraud to me. So AMLO keeps campaigning. He keeps campaigning. He keeps campaigning. And he does something before the 2018 election, like 5 years before, he breaks with the PRD and starts to construct his own political party, Morena, Party of Moral Regeneration. And he does something that I would have thought impossible. He constructs a viable political party out of whole cloth, and he starts to rebuild the working class movement from the top down. Not from the bottom up, right? You would hope from the bottom up, right? But he sort of, you know, the working class has been thoroughly defeated. It's been smashed. It's been destroyed. Any power that it had has been disseminated, completely deconstructed since the neoliberal turn of the 1980s. And he starts to rebuild something. And not only that, he wins a landslide. This is just old style campaigning. AMLO went, in the years running up to the 2018 election, AMLO visited every fucking village in Mexico.
I believe it.
Often more than once.
I believe it.
He went out, he pressed the flesh, he hugged everybody because he's a very hands-on kind of politician. Everybody took a selfie with AMLO. He made speeches. And in this process, he convinced people that he was authentic and legitimate and not a corrupt politician in the pre or pan mold or even the PRD mold. And of course he won in a landslide, right? He and his political allies won. Now, he did do certain things leading up to that election that raise eyebrows on the left. One of them was that, you know, his two coalition partners, one is the Worker Party, the PT, a Lenin, a party that has hammers and sickles.
Yes, I see the billboard. Do you know how odd it is?
Yes, I do.
Brother Lancaster, to see
how wonderful it is, actually. How wonderful it is. So the PT is legit, right? I mean, they're a hardcore left party. And AMLO has never been afraid to stand on a stage with his PT allies beside him flying the hammer and sickle flag, right? So there's like, let's think about what kind of politician he is, right? And where he came from and his commitment to some kind of a left vision, right? His other coalition party though is the PES, and I've got off of a party of Encuentros Sociales. It's a weird evangelical conservative party.
Okay.
Not very large, but you know, they So he has these two allies, one on the left, one on the right. And that was the coalition. And when he was challenged on it, you know, he always said, look, I mean, the kind of transformation that I'm envisioning is too big to be exclusive. It's too big to just to say you can't be part of it because we don't like your ideas. We want a broad spectrum. All right. So that gives rise to all sorts of problems, of course. I mean, he's AMLO punted the question of abortion and gay rights and gay marriage and stuff like that in 2018. And he said, you know, we'll talk about it later, basically.
He Obama'd him.
We'll talk about it later, but we're not going to do it right now. Meanwhile, the courts are deciding these things all in one direction. You know, maybe he was right because he was worried about losing conservative Catholic voters in small towns and rural villages. Given the kind of political coalition he wanted to build, he may have been right. He also inflamed the NGO activists early on in his presidency. And I write about this in the conclusion. But, the NGOs had been running social welfare programs that the government basically paid the NGOs to do various kinds of medical and social welfare programs. And AMLO looked at that and said, no, this is a bad use of state money. Like, public services should be run by the public, not
to give people an example. I don't think there's any state run. If any, I think there's one state run orphanage in Northern Baja, where I am.
Interesting.
I believe it's all run by churches.
Probably. But in this case, you had feminist and gay NGOs, and Walmart had one of the biggest NGOs in Mexico, oddly.
Sounds about right.
Walmart had an NGO that used state money to help families of children with disabilities or sicknesses and so on. So AMLO looked at this very convoluted and complicated arrangement where the state was spending money to support private organizations and said, no, we're going to pull the plug on that. Like, we're going to fortify the state's capacity to deliver services. And in the future, whatever NGOs offer will be of a non-governmental variety. Now, this inflamed a lot of NGO activists. And they never let it go. They never forgave them for cutting them off. And that, I suspect that that's one of the reasons that you saw, you know, feminist riots on International Women's Day every year thereafter, up until the last year. It was part of an elaborate payback by NGOs and NGO activists. So here you've got, you know, all right. So Gloria Sheinbaum, to come back to Claudia Sheinbaum, back to the question you actually posed and not the one that I wanted
to. We need context. Hey, this is a show. Hey, look, first of all, this is the Saturday free show where we can go over an hour. First of all, second of all, these things need context.
That's your context. All right. So here's the promise. Here's the promise, I think. Does Claudia Sheinbaum keep the farmer, peasant, working class base that AMLO built and add to that left-leaning members of re-add back to that because they were lost, you know, re-add back to that the PMC left, the professional managerial class left that belongs to NGOs and activism and international circuits and so on, right? Can she add those back And thereby win another landslide election where there's a constitutional majority. And that's what we're waiting to see. My read is that she certainly got the attention of the NGO types, and she's got their support, right? Mm-hmm. So we'll see how God bless her. I hope she prevails, right? I had worried that having a Jewish woman run for president would be too much for a deeply Catholic culture. And I had wondered about that, but that doesn't seem to have developed. Yeah. Like, that doesn't seem to be the case. Like, she wears that ponytail that echoes the way ordinary indigenous descended Mexican women dress. She dresses like a respectable office worker. You know,
that's a really good analogy.
It's not fancy dress.
That's a good analogy.
It's a typical woman office worker. And when I look at the scenes of her campaigning, you know, the way ordinary working class and lower middle class Mexican women embrace her, it's like, oh, yes, honey, you're one of us.
Those aren't fancy. Look, there's no polo stores here. Right. And she's not going across the border to pick up any designer stuff. She looks like a bank manager.
She looks like a lower level middle management. And she also gives off a vibe. I don't know how to put this right. But like sometimes she gives off a vibe that like she wouldn't be bad to work under. Like if you were being managed by her at the workplace, she wouldn't be horrible.
She would give lots of pizza parties.
So here, look, I mean, you know, she's stiff and she's kind of like, I think, you know, what, I don't know if you watched the debate. I watched the debate a couple of weeks ago and Galvez, her PAN pre-PRD coalition. That's right. Cause they all got in bed together, right? All of the other political parties in the country formed a coalition to try to stop her. Right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Galvez kept saying, "You're a cold and unfeeling woman," and like that is literally. Eres una mujer muy fría y sin sentimientos, so something like that was mm-hmm. the exact phrase. And so there is, you know, but so she is a bit stiff. She is a bit cautious. She speaks slowly. AMLO also spoke very slowly.
I mean, she's a scientist, though, right? If I'm not mistaken.
She's a fucking physicist.
Physicist. She's a Nobel Prize winning physicist, right?
Is she?
She's a Nobel Prize winner.
I don't remember that, but maybe she was part of a team that won the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, I believe so. I believe
she's a very look. All right, she doesn't wear this learning on her sleeve, like she doesn't show it off, right? She's very careful not to show off, right? Mm-hmm. Because that would be unseemly, and it would also be, you know,
it would be off-putting.
You got the base to think about here. Yeah. But she's an extremely accomplished woman who's devoted her life to politics, who could have easily had a career as an extraordinarily well-paid scientist, instead she has devoted her life to politics, and she hasn't gotten rich in the process, as far as anyone can see. Another snarky remark by Galvez after the debate was something like, "Well, if you haven't," Sheinbaum said that she lived in an apartment. Mm-hmm. And Galvez said, she lives in an apartment, not a house. So like, if you haven't acquired assets by the age of 60, don't you think you're a little bit slow? Mm-hmm. Eres un poco güey. You're a bit of a slouch, don't you think? But that's, like, let's be clear, that does not hurt her in the polls. That and that remark does hurt Galvez in the polls, I think. So I don't know. I'm hoping for a 60-40 showing at I'm hoping for a landslide. I'm hoping for a constitutional majority again. I'm hoping that the second floor of the fourth transformation, as she's been dubbing it, right? I'm hoping that that gets off very well. She did. She had a 30-second, you know, video, and among the images that she shows you, I don't know, indigenous women, working class men, something, a gay kid in front of a rainbow flag, something, as she goes through a series of images that gives you a sense of the kind of a coalition that she's trying to build.
But there's no black people, right? I'm just kidding.
I don't know. Actually, I have to look.
There shouldn't have been. There's like 8 in the whole country.
Well, there's. You know what? This is an interesting question. You've got us off on an interesting question, right? I mean, actually, there are Afro-Mexican villages on the coast of Oaxaca and on the coast of Veracruz and in a few places. They've often blended with indigenous populations and are hard to discern on phenotypic characteristics, right? I mean, but there is a kind of a blending of African and indigenous in certain coastal zones. And
I know we're a huge minority, and that's okay. I was just teasing. I was totally teasing. I do want to shift gears a little bit and get back to the book.
Sure.
I don't want to use the word intersectionality, but you discuss the intersection of race and class in this book and how it relates to the struggle to be gay. And in the first chapter, you talk about a person you name Eric. And I was telling you off air that got to me. It got to me. So...
Good.
You're doing something right, right? It's like you've written a book or two before.
This one was 30 years ago, believe it or not. Oh, so yeah.
But the story of Eric was I don't want to say bittersweet, because I don't think it is bittersweet. It was a heartbreaking story. You want to tell us a little bit about Eric?
I'll try. So Eric is one of 13 children. He grew up in a working class type farming family. His mother converted to Jehovah's Witness and took a lot of the family along with her when she converted. So he grew up in a certain kind of a milieu that belongs to, village life in the surrounding area around the city of Puebla. And I tried to recount his experiences. I kicked the book off with that as a first chapter, because I think it gives you a good immersion into common experiences. He is struggling with coming out. And, you know, I record some of our conversations. It's around 2010, I think. Maybe 2011.
I think the book says 2011.
I date stamp them in the book. So I don't remember what it is, but I date stamp them, right? Yeah. So he's struggling with coming out, and we're having conversations about it. And, you know, I'm saying, well, you know, it's not as bad as it used. Like, lighten up, man. It's better than it used to be. And he's, well, you know, my cousin came out and his family ran him out of the house. He lived on the streets, and now nobody ever mentions his name. And I, yeah, okay. But it's all right. We go back and forth. Eventually, though, his father discovers photos and journal entries and stuff like that, and kidnaps the boy, and the father and two older brothers kidnap the boy and subject him to a week of beatings and chastisements.
Which is insane to think about.
It is insane to think.
It's insane to think that, you know, oh, you're doing what?
A 20-year-old strapping young man allows himself, if you will, to be kidnapped by a very old man, of course, accompanied by two brothers. But there's respect for family authority involved and all of that. And
is there shame involved?
There's certainly shame involved. So they put him through a week of shaming, and they put him through a week of that. And I was surprised at the outcome. I mean, he's on the phone with his secret phone because the first thing they did was they took his phone, but he had a secret backup phone somewhere, right? He's been on the phone with his boyfriend, and he's been in contact with a few other people. And to my surprise, he toughed it out, right? To my surprise, he toughed it out, and he didn't. So what happens in the process of this is that he neither exactly comes out, nor does he exactly stay in the closet.
Purgatory.
His father says, I don't want to talk about it anymore. I don't want to hear about it anymore. And you will not bring men to this house. Right? That's there. Mm-hmm. So the father reaches a kind of settlement after being unable to impose his will. Right? I don't want to talk about it anymore. I don't want to hear about it. Meaning I don't want to hear about it from the neighbors, which is part of what happened. Mm-hmm. And you will not bring men to this, you won't bring men to this house, right? All right. So there's a kind of a, it didn't much change the way Eric lived and behaved. He still went out with his boyfriend. He still went on the gay scene. But you could always see him looking around to make sure that there was no one from his neighborhood or no family members in the immediate area who might see him, right? And that's so I, you know, he his strategy is one that I think is common for working class people in Mexico, but not only in Mexico, in lots of other settings, right? It's neither a seamless, transparent coming out, nor is it being completely repressed. I use the Spanish verb aguantar, which is used greatly commonly in Mexico, and it's basically, he puts up with it, he withstands it, he endures it, he suffers it. Mm-hmm. There's a verb that is used a lot in Mexico for things like this, and that is his strategy. So there's my opening gambit. It's the story of a boy who neither comes out nor remains in the closet, but puts up with it, suffers it, endures it. And I think that's a good lead into the next chapter is a whole series of life stories. Short, not long life, but little short life segments of people who are often having similar experiences.
But it's the class component for me that brings it home, because, the first thing for me that hit me moving here was the stark divide.
Right.
Right. That you, it's so visual.
Yeah.
And you kind of, you know, you're always talking about in the book that there's a certain life that these middle class gay men get to live, that the Erics of the world's life is so foreign to them. And you can enjoy these kind of advancements in acceptance in a way that the Erics can't. Kind of back to that original, the way the book jumps off, where, you know, the homie is reminding you, yeah, but these kids got to go back home. And at one point in Eric's story, he's about to marry a woman.
Yes, his mother very carefully tried to, is very insistently pushed him into an arrangement that is like, why don't you marry that childhood friend of yours? You know,
and it's so sad. They're about to, they send out invitations. They're about to get married.
Yeah.
And the young lady goes, hey, before we get married, let's do it. And dude's like, ew. All the gay comes out right there.
All the gay came out, right? My spirit abandoned me, as he elegantly put it. And she says, she's the wise beyond her years, she says, and this is indicative too, so it's true what they say. You really are gay. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell anyone. Mm-hmm. But we are not going to be married. Right. So, and then they, you know, they sent out new anti-invitations, yeah, or whatever, like, retractions of the invitations to, I mean, look, if I've done this well, if I've done this right, there are all sorts of horrible, embarrassing, humiliating, awkward moments that I recount in people's lives. And I do it, I hope, with a sense of support and love and all of that, not with a sense of scandal mongering or detachment. I mean, these remind me of my friends from rural North Carolina, yeah, as much as any. These remind me of events in my own life. These remind me of what it was like growing up, you know, rural working class in North Carolina. So I talk about commonalities of experiences, not just in Mexico, but in other parts of the world as well.
And I think you do a good job of that by not trying to say, no, I totally understand everything this person's going through, because I had a similar. It's like, yeah, it's similar, but it's still very different than
different. What, similar, but different.
Cats,
yeah.
What,
yeah,
these cats are dealing with.
I will never know what it's like to have the Virgin of Guadalupe watching over me, right? I will never be able to I will never feel that, right? I mean, there are things that I say at the outset, I'm not going to pretend to understand from the inside. I don't know what it was like growing up in a dictatorship. Exactly.
Yeah. yeah. Say what you will about the conservative 80s, it's not a dictatorship.
Yeah, not quite. Not, it was bad, but it wasn't like, you know,
a little different.
Yeah.
In your research, how have you seen traditional Mexican masculinity and machismo influence attitudes towards homosexuality? What shifts, if any, have you observed in recent years?
Well, this is interesting. You've asked a tough question, right? So I should be able to give you a better answer than I can. After all, my second book was set in Nicaragua with the word machismo in the subtitle. There it is. So like the first thing I thought I know, like, machismo in Nicaragua always seemed much more prominently figured to me than machismo in Mexico. So there's something. I know Mexico is the land of machismo, but like, yeah, it seemed more exaggerated as a concept in Nicaragua. Clearly, the authority of the father is paramount in the system of masculinity in Mexico. And part of what you see with Eric is a certain, and other people that I write about, a certain degree of submission to the authority of the father. This is a somewhat different framing than what I talked about in Nicaragua, because, you know, fathers in Nicaragua were mostly absent. It was mostly female headed households, and so on and so on. But in Mexico, you had a more conservative marriage and kinship system. The authority of the father was very strong. And in fact, it's only been within the past decade that those laws derived from the Napoleonic Code giving the father authority over everyone in the family, including the wife, have been revised, first by court rulings and then by legislative overhauls. So there's a very strong sense that fathers are in control, a very strong sense that everyone obeys them and does what they say to do. And that gives this cultural element a stronger heft, I think, in Mexico than in the US, for example. I think if a father said, you know, I was talking with friends about this many years ago, and it's like, you know, the typical father in the, you know, in the US, if a father said, you will do what I say as long as you live under this roof. Half the time the response would be laughter, mm-hmm. right? Half the time the response would be laughter. Like, fuck you, daddy. I'm not going to. What? You're going to throw me out? Like, I'll call social services on your ass. All right. Not always, but like at least half the time. In Mexico, you'll do what I say as long as you live under this roof. Typically, the child, even an adult son will hang his head down and do it. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's different. That's different. But there's kind of a stacking and compounding of things here, right? So being poor has its disadvantages, right? So in Eric's case, being poor puts you at a disadvantage. Being poor, whose family belonged to a religious cult that specifically cultivates poor people, right? The Jehovah's Witness, that makes it worse. Being poor in a religious sect, and like not having higher education is a protector against some of the most extreme forms of abuse, right? So you get this stacking of effects. All of them have something to do with being poor and working class. All of them are connected to that, some of them contingently so, but you need all of those in view to, and then of course the cultural overlay, which is to say a deeply patriarchal tradition and legal basis and so on. All of those elements come into play here.
I do want to touch on, we're coming up on the hour. Can you stay a little longer, or you got places?
Sure, I can stay a little longer. I hope I'm not being boring. And
No, that's what... That's why I'm asking you, goddamn.
All right, sure. We'll make it happen.
Because there's some things we touched on off air that I definitely want to get to. But I think for people to get a good understanding of your book, you know, we're trying to sell a few copies here on the show. There's some things that I think we should hit on.
It's the most beautiful book cover anyone has ever experienced. It actually is a wonderful cover, and I thank the press. I got a painting by Fabian Chaires. I wrote to him and asked him if I could use this painting. Fabian Chaires is a famous gay painter in Mexico. He is the artist who painted Zapata in Heels, which triggered rioting when it was displayed at the Beaux-Arts Museum in Mexico City.
I can see that.
Zapata's descendants showed up.
I can see that.
It was a scene. They roughed up museum staff.
I could see that.
It brought out the president. AMLO had to, like, look, I mean, this is important. Like, the Museo de Bellas Artes is the center of Mexican cultural life. And what happens there is a very big deal nationally. It's not like, you know, some second-rate museum in the U.S. AMLO came out and had to make a statement about it. And he said the right thing. He said, look, Mexico is a free country. We have free expression here. You can't go around punching writers and artists in the nose just because you don't like what they said or painted. Thank you, President AMLO. Yeah. This was the right thing to say.
One of the good things that AMLO did. Can you explain progressive neoliberalism and how in Mexico, for example, it aided in progressive policies towards gay rights? I believe Mexico City legalized gay marriage in 2009.
I think that sounds about right. It was certainly by 2010. I mean, there was a process.
I mean, the country as a whole,
right?
I think 2022 is when everybody agreed, but for 2015, I think there was something passed that said, hey, we have
to. It's hard to keep track of. So first of all, Mexico City got gay civil union.
That's what it was.
I've got it in the book somewhere, but I don't remember numbers. But it might have been 2007. It was fairly, I think as soon as AMLO got defeated in 2006, remember, they had kept this bottled up in committee, in part because AMLO, even though he let the gay scene flourish in Mexico City, he did not want to be running in a race against socially conservative candidates who would say, but you legalized blah, 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 right? So as soon as that election was over, the Mexico City legislature passed gay civil unions in 2009. And then a couple of years later, they upgraded it to marriage. It was either 2009, 2010. So that was that began a series of court challenges. So Mexico went the slow route over a period of several years. You know, first of all, the Supreme Court of Mexico established that a marriage performed in Mexico City had to be recognized by all the other states. So you're like, at that point, it was over. Like, at that point, give it up, right? Like, you're fighting a losing battle. And then gradually, more and more states passed gay marriage. By 2018, I think 2017, 2018, even stodgy conservative Puebla was reluctantly giving gay marriage giving gay marriage ceremonies, right? My partner and I took advantage of that and got married in Puebla. It was very funny. We had a wonderful magistrate. She was amusing and funny and told jokes the whole way. Not a hint of homophobia came off of her. She was very accepting. And then, like, we get to the scene where we're supposed to sign the documents, and she looks at it and she says, "So which one of you wants to be the girl?" because we were still using those documents that had you know, wife and husband on.
Yeah.
And Enrique said, "I'll do it." So anyway, it worked out. We have our official marriage license has the old gendered stuff on it, but you know, that was even stodgy Puebla, right? Was doing it by then, and I think they've changed their marriage laws since. But they were doing it under court order when we did it. So you've got to, you know, all right. You asked a question about neoliberalism and gay rights, and it's an interesting story. It's a long story. I take two or three chapters to lay it out, I think fairly carefully, but, so the old regime was a center left dictatorship.
I think people are going to have a hard time hearing center-left dictatorship.
They might, but it was like the pre-maintained observer status in the Socialist International all those years, joined as an official member in 2003, I think. Mm-hmm. The PRI has roots in the Mexican Revolution, mm-hmm. and those roots included socialist, social democratic, anarchist, sometimes communist, liberal, conservative. Those roots include a number of different kinds of factions, right? But certainly the presidency of Lázaro Cárdenas put what was the slogan of the presidency of Lázaro Cárdenas? For a workers' democracy. That was a little too much for subsequent presidents to bear. So they retired that official slogan of the PRI. But so the PRI is a kind of a center-left dictatorship, and it lasted all those many years. It's true that, like, you know, maybe by 1968, when the regime slaughtered protesting students,
yeah,
in Tlatelolco, mm-hmm. By 1968, you had a very serious loggerhead. You had the viciousness of the regime was exposed, and I don't undersell it. And even after the slaughter of, it's unclear how many hundreds of students, they went on a campaign. They went on a low-level assassination campaign and to clean up the left in rural villages, to suppress youth countercultures in Mexico. But this was like the figure responsible for that, who then goes on to become president. Even so, it was very close to Fidel Castro. Maintained close ties to Allende's Chile. Was very friendly with the PLO. In other words, there was still enough of a left-wing tradition in the PRI that you had a certain posture there, right? And, you know, anti-imperialist pro-labor rhetoric was not unusual for the PRI at that point, right? So you had, like, by 68, the revelation of a kind of a vicious hypocrisy. But even so, you still have, you know, a country that's nationalized oil, that's nationalized the subsoil, that redistributes through broadly redistributive mechanisms, that's increasingly corrupt. Like, don't lose track of the corruption. Like, that was a real thing, and it really bugged the fuck out of people. But all right, so then, you know, 1982, the bottom falls out, and Mexico embarks on, you know, the bottom fell out precisely because of the Volcker shocks, right? Mm-hmm. So the price of oil comes down, the interest rates go up. Mexico is unable to pay the interest on its short-term debts and defaults. It had used those short-term debts to nationalize industries, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the bottom falls out. Mexico then embarks on a neoliberal path from 1982 on. And it's an increasingly neoliberal path. The government sells off its assets more and more. You know, this creates the richest man in the world for a while, Carlos Slim. Carlos Slim was not an especially wealthy Mexican before. He was a political crony, and he acquired Telmex, the Mexican national phone company, for a song. He didn't even pay anything out of pocket.
Jesus.
He repaid the state gradually based on profits over the next few years, right? He didn't, nothing out of pocket. And he turned this monopoly into a constant money source, got in early with cellular, and catapulted himself to the richest man in the world for several years. All right. So the story of neoliberalism.
Sounds kind of like post-Soviet Russia.
A lot like that, yes. Yeah. A lot like that. The political cronyism was your best way of getting access to the state goods that were being sold off. And remember, Mexico, because it was a center-left dictatorship, had a lot of public goods, right? The railroads, train services, et cetera. The electrical company, I think, remains national, but you know. All right, so the 1980s, the lost decade, everyone is eating shit because the fiscal crisis goes on and on. The IMF imposes harsher and harsher requirements. Life expectancies decline, infant mortality increases, you know, average height drops. And like by all measures, the 1980s were grueling. So you have that period when neoliberalism is imposed, and it's still rolling out into the 90s, right? So.
And does NAFTA hyper speed
NAFTA, that up? NAFTA 1994, yeah. In the run up to NAFTA, they do even more things to put working class and peasant people at a great disadvantage. So, and then the second fiscal crisis, 1994, the tequila crisis, happens in rapid succession, and you get another several years of intense suffering. So let's be clear, the neoliberal transition decimated working class power across Mexico. It snatched out from under people all the kinds of supports that had been developed under the center-left regime. And we're talking subsidies. We're talking small business subsidies, small farm subsidies, you know, all kinds of things like that. And exposed people to perilous, dire conditions. And that continues all the way on through Vicente Fox's term in 2000 to 2006. It's one long story of the rolling out of neoliberalism and the kinds of suffering that caused. But at the same time, like, this is the tricky part of the book, right? This is where things, you know, your listeners may agree or disagree, right? Or your readers may be annoyed, or maybe I am annoyed, right? At the same time, because you have a dictatorship in decline, because you have traditional forms of political discipline in decline, you also have the growth of certain kinds of personal freedoms. And those become more evident in the 90s than in the 80s, but certainly by the 90s. All right, think about you have a proliferation of satellite dishes everywhere. Mm-hmm. And Mexicans use pilfered codes to get onto the world via satellite dishes. Mm-hmm. Everybody had pilfered codes. I don't know. How do you run a whole country off pilfered codes?
I'm still trying to figure out how you run a whole country off stolen power.
Maybe, yeah. So remember that that Mexico had had two TV stations, Televisa mm-hmm. and TV Azteca. One was Azteca was state owned and very friendly to the government, and Televisa never got in the way of the government about anything, right? So you had two TV stations, and they closely guarded information. But once those satellite dishes went up, you had alternative sources of information. You had alternative viewpoints. You had access to the whole world. That would have been significant enough. But by 1990, I'm thinking 3, 4, 5, certainly by 5, right? Because this happened very quickly. By 1995, you've got internet cafes all over the place. Now, people couldn't afford their own laptop, or they couldn't afford a desktop.
Yeah.
But they could spend 50 cents an hour to go hook up to the World Wide Web in an internet cafe.
Which is still very popular where I'm at.
Really?
Brother.
That's interesting, because they've all but disappeared in Puebla. They've all but disappeared.
I walked into one like, hey, are you guys from another time?
Right. But look at it. Look at it. You've got young people hooked up to the web. You've got their parents watching cable, watching satellite dish and then cable. So you had a major transformation of the media sphere, right? You've had a major transformation of that. People have access to other kinds of information. Gay people are hooking up online. And they're getting access to things and so on. And you get this reflected in Mexican cinema, Mexican TV shows. Music becomes more rebellious. You get figures like Gloria Trevi who are like trafficking in scandal and shock. And so you've had a major transformation of the scene under neoliberal conditions, especially with new media happening. The advent of new media, which is part of neoliberal globalization, kind of adds to that mix. By the 1990s, then, let's say, for example, the Zócalo in the Central Plaza in Puebla has become very cruisy. And like openly cruisy, not it hadn't been before, mm-hmm. right? But it becomes very openly cruisy. And it was also true that the cops used to hassle gays if they hung out in space. The cops kind of, all right, you know, they've seen the Televisa problem of the week about homophobia movie. Mm-hmm. Too, and they kind of start to lay off, and you have a much more open scene. 2000, Vicente Fox comes in. Mm-hmm. And this is when things really shift in my view and in my retelling of it. So Vicente Fox was a social conservative historically, part of the Catholic Party, if you want to call it that, right? The PAN was a conservative Catholic party. And Vicente Fox's election was not very promising. I mean, he's a loudmouth, affable Reaganite figure who makes strange jokes. And like he referred to the pre-candidate La Bastida as La Vestida in debates. He called him the drag queen, basically. Mm-hmm. So people of liberal views are scandalized and they're freaked out and they think, oh my God, like the conservative Catholics are going to be in power. I don't, like, this is going to be bad. But But Vicente Fox had campaigned on a promise to leave civil society alone. Now, remember, the center-left dictatorship had never let civil society be. They always were like, no. Too many gay bars, like be more discreet, or you're organizing what club? So Vicente Fox campaigns on a promise to respect civil society, a new thing, okay? And he did. Not only did he respect civil society, within 2 years, he's forming a commission to draft a national law that will, like, consolidate a happy relationship between the neoliberal state and civil society. In other words, the legislation empowers NGOs to be involved in national development projects and so on. Thus begins the flow of money to NGOs that AMLO eventually unplugs, right? But in all of this, local authorities, whether they belong to one party or the other, stop harassing gay establishments. They stop sitting on liquor licenses and so on. And what you get under Fox is a flourishing of gay scenes, even in second tier cities like Puebla. I mean, the scenes go off the hook in Mexico City and Guadalajara, but even in conservative second tier cities like Puebla, you have a visible flourishing gay scene. So the relationship, all to say, you know, I try to lay this out under the rubric of the gay dialectic or something, right? And I call it the gay dialectic, right? So, you know, everyone who's lived under capitalism has lived under exploitation, mm-hmm. and under clawback and under conditions where workers are oppressed. That's everyone who's lived under capitalism has experienced that. But they've also often experienced spaces that open up for free expression or for experimentation or for forms of social life to be developed that are experienced as liberatory and are along at least certain dimensions. Right. So there's the picture I tried to draw out. I do it by recounting, you know, historical deep dives, yeah. and scenes from different years. And so, you know, my observations go back 4 decades. If you think about it, right. I mean, my first visits were in 83 and 84. So it's a long-term process. And then, of course, you know, neoliberalism then reacts in a different way and shuts down a lot of those scenes, at least for a while. But now they seem to be coming back again. So anyway.
Is the struggle to be gay for the poor and working class getting better? Or has that needle not really moved over the last decade or so? You start the book with Eric, who is his family converts to being Jehovah's Witness. I cannot speak for the whole of Mexico, but for where I am here in Baja, Jehovah's Witness there's more than the Mormons here.
And there are a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses everywhere in Mexico. It's a surprisingly large.
They're doing a lot of, I almost said colonizing, converting, if you will. And there was one that would come to my house, because when I do have free time, I have this terrace, is why I got this place, or I rent. But there's a beautiful terrace that overlooks the ocean. You're more than welcome. And there's gentlemen. They're going door to door, and he sees me out there, and he yells something about wanting a better world or some shit like that. I'm like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, And he starts talking about Jesus, and unbeknownst to this man, I was up at 3 o'clock in the morning, my time, interviewing a Marxist theologian on the history of Jesus. You know, so I had to read this book. I'm just all hyped up on all things Jesus at the moment. So maybe I'm not the good person to talk about on the historical Jesus from a Jehovah's Witness, but he was intrigued by the conversation. I'm not going to lie, I was kind of having a good time, you know, throwing these things back at him and making him kind of figure it out, to the point where he came back 2 weeks later. Roger, I'm not trying to be funny.
It came back 2 weeks later to take it back up again.
Right? Yeah, with the Bible, he had all the Bible verses, and he brought a homie with him. Right.
He probably sought some help from a colleague
he come back with the homies. Like, hey, there's this colored fella over here in the Colonia that's making me think about Jesus. And eventually, because I don't know anything about Jehovah's. All I know about Jehovah's Witnesses is that Michael Jackson's one. They don't have birthdays. That's all I knew.
Eric was surprised when I told him that the Jehovah's Witnesses had originated in the United States, because he thought they were a Mexican church.
There's so many. I would say the majority of the black people that I see here in Baja are Jehovah's Witnesses. They got stationed here, right? And what a horrible place to get stationed, coastal, you know, California. Yeah,
we all feel for you.
Yeah.
But say what you will, I mean, about the Jehovah's Witnesses, and there's, oh my God, like, I suppose like any sect, they're very proud. Like, I try to be fair with them, right, in a way, because you've, under neoliberalism, you've had massive dislocation of working class life, especially in indigenous villages and poor barrios and places like that. You've had massive social dislocation.
Yeah.
And associated with that social dislocation comes problems like alcoholism and wife beating.
Yeah.
And serious forms of personal disintegration. And the Jehovah's Witnesses offer these people a lifeline. They say, you know, we'll help you get your shit together. You believe with us and you'll stop beating your wife, you'll stop being drunk, your life will be better. And a lot of people sign on. Like, I understand the appeal, right? And again, like, as intolerant as they are, they have always been an anti-racist formation. Like, they have always been anti-racist, right?
So that's the thing that's crazy. So the guy comes here, eventually comes with his kid. He's got like an older daughter. You know, I have older children. We'd have coffee. It was like his Tuesday thing. And we get to the part about the gays.
Oh, yeah. Let's get started on the gays now.
I didn't know. And he goes, well, you know, we don't like the gays. And I look over at his kid.
You're thinking, I read your kid as being.
And I was like, word? And he's like, is that a hang up for you? I was like, is that a hang up for me? I was like, well, what do you have against the gays? And he's, you know, the whole thing is he'll show me a Bible verse.
Yeah.
And my whole thing is like, okay, but you know, it's, if you want to believe that there's only 10 commandments, you know, probably more than 10 commandments in the Bible, if you really break it down. There's a lot of rules in this book that don't make a lot of sense. And it's based off the time in which it's supposed to be written. It's not a linear story the way you want to put it together. And he's agreeing with me on a lot of this stuff. And I'm like, and the thing about the gays, right? Like still today, that's what you want to believe?
Right.
And he was like, hey, it's in the Bible. I was like, you can't eat shellfish in this book.
Yeah. You can't have a blood transfusion. I will. I believe that too. So the Jehovah's Witnesses have been part of my professional life all the way back all the way back to the Nicaragua days, because part of what I looked at in the very poor slums of Nicaragua were some of the conversions to Jehovah's Witness there during a revolutionary period, but also a period of, you know, life during wartime and so on. So I developed that weirdly tolerant version of the Jehovah's Witnesses looking at poor people who had converted in Nicaragua in the 80s just to try to get some stability in their lives. And oddly enough, that story, you know, that story still kind of carries forward into Mexico. Like, it's pretty clear to me that the that Eric's family was similarly dislocated and unhappy about it and feeling all of that, and move into a sect that gives them some comfort, right? And some
and like you said, some support. Sometimes they give like literal financial support if people really need it within the church.
It's an interesting experience. And then I was in the Zona Rosa one day. It must have been 2000 or like sometime around there. And so this young black woman from the U.S. approaches me, and she's got the watchtower with her. And I say, uh-oh, I know where this is going. And so she's striking up her proselytizing conversation. And I say, oh, Jehovah's Witnesses. Yeah, my husband's a Jehovah's Witness. And then she kind of chills down. And I say, wait, aren't you going to try to convert me? And she says, nah, you're too far gone. You're a lost cause. And it was sweet. She was respectful, more or less. And it was, you know, you're a lost cause. But I couldn't help but see her smirk and smile a little bit, because I think she realized how weird was her church's doctrine on this.
Right? Again, I didn't know anything, because I don't give too much of a shit. I grew up in a church, a offshoot of Pentecostalism as a young person. So I have an understanding of the Bible. I went to Catholic school my freshman year of high school, so I definitely read it a few times.
Oh, wow. But, Pentecostal and Catholic school. That's going to be it.
Oh, dude. Yeah, I've seen it all. I'm, you know, there's certain religions that I check out just because some people are nice. You know, once a young man, we were on tour, and he told us if we went with him to the synagogue, they would feed us. So we hung out at a synagogue in South Carolina. I'm not afraid of anyone's God, put it that way. But the Jehovah's Witnesses were pretty hardcore.
It's weird. Here's the weird thing. They don't believe in hell. They don't believe in hell. This is strange. I've often had these conversations with my Jehovah's Witnesses subjects, right? So like, you don't believe in hell? No, a just God would never make you burn forever. Like, that's something the Catholics invented. And they sort of have a point. Like, the notion of hell is kind of vague in the Bible. It's hard to suss out, right? Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, they don't have like excess cruelty built in, right? But on the other hand, well, then what's your punishment? Like, hell is basically for us being separated from God. And I say, what's that like? Well, that means that when you die, you just kind of like go to sleep and you never wake up. And I said, well, that sounds good to me. Like, that doesn't sound so bad. I mean, so they have a set of ideological notions that are weirdly tolerant and kind. And then on the other hand, they somehow leverage that to keep people very much under control and very much, I mean, yeah, very much under control. And Yeah, someday we'll do a book on that too, I suppose. But
like I said, it's there's a lot of them. I love it when I go on my run hike and they're out there like football players with their telling everybody, directing like a huddle. I live on a dirt road, dude. it's a bitch to come up here and do all your proselytizing. But how does Mexico compare with other Latin American countries when it comes to the rights of the LGBT community?
This is a good question. I mean, look, I think for a while there was a competition between Mexico and Argentina. And it was a problem because Argentina got out there first, if I'm remembering correctly, with gay marriage. And so, Mexico City, the officials there were upset because they had been passed by and they couldn't claim first place in this. So that was part of why they rushed to pass things in Mexico City. But it took a little while longer in the rest. Things have changed all across Latin America, and they've changed with the exception of a few countries that haven't, right? But there's been a wave of change, more acceptance, less harassment, a modicum of legal rights, and I don't know. It seems I suspect that it's not altogether different from other Latin American countries, but I know them less. It has not been advanced in Nicaragua. I mean, in Nicaragua, the Ortega regime has been rather repressive of gays' rights, women's rights, and other things like that.
What about El Salvador? Because their president's pretty.
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like DC is like the capital of El Salvador. I feel like I should know more. There are probably a 500,000 Salvadorans living in the DC area.
Word.
Yeah.
It's you guys have a gang problem?
It's a very big immigrant group here.
Do you guys have a bit of a gang problem? So it's not like California was in the 80s and 90s.
These are mostly people. These are people who have tried to escape
the gangs. Okay.
In El Salvador, I think mostly. And it's a different, of course there are gangs here. There are gangs everywhere. But they don't seem to me to be terribly visible. And sometimes you would hear, local police officials or something fretting about the Salvadoran gangs because somebody had put up some graffiti. All right. You got one piece of graffiti, right? Like, I need more than that to go on to think that there's a
run in the city.
I need a little more than that to think about like a gang infestation, right? Like one Batos Locos graffiti.
Somebody watched Mi Vida Loca and it was like, okay.
El Salvador, I don't know. So it would be really interesting to know more about, I don't know what that crazy man is doing there in terms of this,
I haven't heard people talk about him from a moral standpoint and how he feels about that. Everything seems to be about his economic and, kind of tough on crime policies. So I would love to know, because he's a younger cat. So it feels like
it's a tough thing to put 2% of your population in prison. Like that beats even the U.S. at its peak when we had 1% of the population.
They're killing a bunch too. That's getting totally underreported.
He's doubled that number, and it's rather extreme.
You should listen to right wing radio because they love him.
Oh yeah, I'm sure they do.
Because we're tough on crime laws.
The thing is that, I'm sort of tired of hearing this story, right? Like I've looked at the numbers. It's true. El Salvador had a terrible homicide spike. They had a terrible crime spike after the war. Mm-hmm. We know this happens. Like post-war countries go through turmoil, dislocation. High crime rates is an obvious part of that. You had it in the U.S. after the Civil War. You had it in El Salvador after the Civil War. You had all kinds, like, all right, we know the story. Then there's a second chapter, right, in El Salvador. The gangs, it starts to come down.
Yeah.
But the gangs keep it relatively elevated. It goes back up a little bit. But then over several years, it starts to come down again. All right, we think, I'm speaking as an anthropologist here, right? We think that high crime rates eventually heal themselves. How's that? There's a kind of a social process that happens that starts to pacify that and to bring it back down to norms again, right? And you saw that. And in fact, you know, all the strategies of this guy, of Bukele's predecessor, and even his early attempts at basically negotiating with the gangs were also bringing it down, right? And then he goes off the, like, quite a bit down, right? And then he goes off the hook because there's that one display of gang resilience or something, and he has a crackdown. Mm-hmm. Now, if we believe official figures, the homicide rate then goes down some more, a lot more. But a lot more. It had already been coming down.
A ton more.
And you don't want, like, so is the lesson that you suspend civil rights, lock up people without a hearing, run 200 people at a time through a judge to put them in prison for, is this how you're going to deal with it? Like, I understand that people in El Salvador like the results, mostly, unless they have a son or a brother who's been caught up in this crackdown. I understand that most people like the results.
I think people like to see – I think this goes across cultural lines. I think this goes across country lines. I think we like to see massive sweeps. Because when we see it, we just think, well, what were you doing to get caught up in the first place? That's what scares me about the quote-unquote success of El Salvador. Right. Because it's being touted as, look, they had this violent country. There's now foreign investment in said violent country. And they don't get into the nuance of why there's all this weird foreign investment, a lot of it's crypto and no taxes and blah, blah, blah. But it's these massive sweeps people see. They see that everyone in jail with face tattoos.
Right.
And they're like, you got the bad guys. Why can't we do that back home? And people forget.
And you also caught up some innocent people in those nets.
But, you know, you don't. No one stops to think about that until 20 right. years later when your country's Innocence Project right. does their Netflix documentary.
Unless it was your brother or son.
Right. And then you have to fight for 25 years so they can have 5 years of freedom before they die.
Right. We don't even know for sure. I mean, I don't think El Salvador ever released official vote tallies. They were reported on Twitter. They were reported on Twitter by Bukele. But I don't think the official.
From his phone.
I don't think there was ever an official real release of the vote. Now, I'm sure he won re-election. I'm sure he won it in a landslide, but I'm not sure what that number was. This is why, I mean, this is a problem for AMLO, but it's also a reason to think that AMLO is good. Like, so AMLO came in on it, like he says, we're gonna run down the narco war. And we're gonna do it with hugs.
Yeah.
Not bullets. Now, he didn't mean hug the narco high command. He meant we're going to create opportunities for the base gun, for the base of the narco, for the kids caught up in it. We're going to try to lure them out of a life of crime and back into. We're going to do it gently.
Would you say, Roger, that a lot of Americans look at narco violence as through the lens of the movies and everybody's like a rich Gabiero looking cat with a gold plated 9mm, and they don't understand that a lot of these cats aren't that well to do? It's like the mafia, right?
Yeah, they got
not everybody troops, in the mob. Is
they got troops. They got kids working for them. Kids. They got poor people who need income and got caught up in it. And it's, yeah, it's romantic and it's outlaw and it's gangster and it's all of that. And they get sucked into it. So AMLO refused early on and continues to refuse to have a crackdown, to have a massive set of arrests like that, right? And I think he's right. Like, I'll go out on a limb here. I have unpopular opinions on a lot of things, but let me go out on a limb here, right? He's correct. And that's to his credit. It also is a weak point for him, because one of the things it means is that the homicide rate has been coming down, but it's been coming down more slowly than you would like to see.
Yeah.
6 years, it's come down. It's not, we would like to see it go lower because there's a very high homicide rate in Mexico. The narcos still remain in charge of a lot of stuff. They do a lot of stuff. AMLO did centralize Mexican law enforcement. A lot of people on the left were upset, but again, you need it seems to me you need a strong military police force in order to deal with a problem where the narcos probably have more sophisticated weaponry than you have.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you need some kind of, but he's not been using it in a vulgar or ostentatious. He's not been using it.
No, it's not a hammer. It's not a hammer.
So you've got a lot of stuff going on there. Some people say AMLO has been too friendly with the military.
Yes, that's what I've been reading.
A lot of people want to say that, but like, come on, get real, right? Like, AMLO got into trouble with the military a couple of years into his tenure. And I can't remember the exact details of it. There was a confrontation. The military had captured one of the narco high command's sons. And the narco went crazy in the town around and started shooting shit up. AMLO sent word down to release the boy, like, let him go. Like, better that he go than that hundreds of civilians die in this exchange. The military did not like, there you go, one of the El Chapitos, that's correct, says Bad Lefty. The military did not like that. And they signaled it very like, okay, Mexican military has been withdrawn from politics. This was one of the great triumphs of Lázaro Cárdenas in the 1930s. He, like, the PRI had originally five pillars, and one of them was labor unions, and one of them was peasant unions, and one of them was the military. Mm-hmm. He retired the military. He took it out of the picture. He said, the military no longer participates in political life. And that's good. All right, that's good. The military signaled its displeasure with AMLO in the strongest terms that I've ever seen in Mexico. So it's going to sound mild, but think about what it means in Latin America, right? So the retired, four or five retired generals, they were important. They're retired. Mm-hmm. They're not active. Four or five retired generals signed a letter criticizing the government's comportment in these events. All right. Now, I know that sounds mild as fuck, right? in a region where military coups are the rule rather than the exception, in a region where the military historically gets involved in stuff to very bad effects, this is a very strong signal. After that signal was set, it seems to me that AMLO's government went to great lengths to try to mollify the military. And it, you know, I would have done so. I think any rational person would have probably done so. You don't have a throwdown with the military in a country like Mexico. And one of the things that he's tried to do is to increasingly divert military to projects that you and I, Americans, would understand very well as Army Corps of Engineer type projects, right? Mm-hmm. So he's tried mm-hmm. to steer more of them into things that look like what the Army Corps of Engineer would of Engineers would do in the States. And I think our colleague Jesus Hermosillo has written about this in response to some of those criticisms of AMLO and the military. So yeah, I'm all for using the military to do construction works.
It is interesting. I live near a military base. So if you've ever been to Mexico, and if you haven't, you guys haven't been to Mexico, come visit down here. You will see a convoy every so often of armed men with a big gun on the back of the truck.
Right.
And you may be driving right behind it, just 10-2, you're fine.
But you're in narco zone. See, we don't usually see displays like this in Puebla. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember that when the narco blew up some shit, right? There was this moment when Calderon had freaked out and he had to send military police to occupy the tourist centers all over Mexico, 2007 or 8 or something like that. So I stayed in a cheap hotel with a gaggle of military police. And it was kind of sexy, really, like not to give away too much, but it was kind of hot, but it was also kind of nervous making because these guys, I don't know. But yeah, I still remember after the massacre of those 43 students in Guerrero, some kid from Guerrero was saying, "I'm devastated. Like I wanted to go into the military. Like this was, I thought that this was going to be my, but if you can't trust the military, who can you trust?"
Exactly.
He said, and I'm thinking, oh my God, like you're blowing my mind with that. If you can't trust the military, who can you trust?
But it's interesting because a lot of the people that, again, there's a lot of boomers that have come here to pasture, if you will. And I have coffee with them every so often when I'm working at a neighborhood cafe in downtown Rosarito. And it's interesting to hear these old vets talk about how they feel about seeing armored personnel, because you get a debate every time you see it. If there's three or four OGs, as I call them, around the cafe and we're eating outside, or and the military vehicle goes down the street, one person will always say, "I feel safer whenever I see that vehicle or those vehicles go down the street." And right when they say that, someone else will say, I don't like it.
Right.
I don't think that's how it's supposed to be.
I figure if a shootout starts, I'm less safe than that. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting living in a place where sometimes you can tell there's a narco kid in the school when the military is there, when the school lets out.
Right.
And it's like, why is the military there as crossing guards today?
Wow. Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. It's yeah.
Well, of course, this was always the story. Like you could, any taxi driver would tell you this. So I'm not letting a cat out of the bag or something. Right. But there was always the story that Puebla was a relative safe haven. during that period of narco terror, narco violence, in part because the political class had struck a deal with the narco high command on the premise that you are welcome to stay here, live here with your families, keep it on the down low, and do not bring your squabbling to this place, and you'll be safe and comfortable here. And this was, this I suspect is true. I mean, you know, how do you ever verify a rumor like that? You will notice that when, I forget which president, whether it was Calderon or Peña Nieto, I think maybe Calderon staged an arrest of one of the narco high command. He was living in the suburbs of Puebla. Mm-hmm. They used the Navy to do it.
Interesting.
They used the Navy to do it, not the Army. The Navy was deemed more reliable. And even though the coastline is like nowhere near, like nowhere near, the arrest was undertaken by the Navy.
I grew up in the streets, so I know to keep my eyes where they need to be, and you know, which is not in their business. So, I try not to. It's helped me live this long. So, I do want to ask you this in closing, because I want to again thank you for giving us so much of your time. I really appreciate that.
I hope you enjoyed it.
There's a reason why I've been talking to your silly ass for the last almost 2 hours. It's because I'm having a good time. I hope you are too. Cool. And I look forward to meeting you in real life when we go to DC.
We'll do it. We'll definitely do it. I'm trying not to read the sidebar conversation.
Don't do it.
Because they will distract me and I will start responding.
Okay.
To them.
Unlike the other shows you go on, this show is filled with inside jokes and humor. So there's going to be a lot of humor in these comments.
One of your viewers says, please come back. So there, I have an invitation.
Yes. This is a good show. This is a good show. We were talking about this off air. And if I don't ask you about this, I feel like I have failed in this conversation. I moved here. Didn't know anything about a red light district because, again, I never hung out in Tijuana. Never cared to. And one of the people I've met down here, good friend of mine, older woman, this is a place that she likes to get seafood in the red light district. And she took me to this place that she wanted to go get seafood. We took the bus down. And next to it was this bar that plays metal and punk and goth music, which is right up my alley, and hers too. She used to be a rocker before she was sent down here. And it's become our favorite spot. On a day like today, she's off work. Hey, let's go take the bus down to TJ and hang out at this place. Neither one of us drink. They let us drink water and request music. It's fun, but it is in the middle of this red light district, which is, I'm not the biggest fan, right? No one's smiling, right? It's just sad women out there. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it's raining or cold. Now, you were telling me about these places because I was under the impression that this was the only legal red light district in the country. And you were like, oh, no. And there's a name for it.
Yeah. I mean, in Mexico, they're called zonas de tolerancia, which is to say, you know, the law hasn't exactly been suspended, but violations of things are tolerated. Mm-hmm. And so let's be clear. I mean, the Zona Rosa was basically historically a zona de tolerancia. It was a place where the laws against prostitution and homosexuality and things like that were not enforced, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that was the history of the Zona Rosa. It was called the Pink Zone what was the joke? It was neither red for prostitution nor white for social purity, but somewhere in the middle, right? It was pink. But my former student, Patty Kelly, did her dissertation at CUNY, her dissertation turned into a book called The Zona Galactica, which is about her field work in a state-owned, like apart from having zonas de tolerancia, like there in Tuxtla Gutierrez, there's actually a state-owned brothel. So she did her field work with the prostitutes who made their living in a state-run brothel. It's not the only state-run brothel that Mexico has ever heard of. There have been other experiments going back to the Victorian era. The idea, of course, is to get out in front of the medical and social problems, to get pimps out of it. I mean, sort of the state becomes your pimp, as it were, right?
Is that a better pimp? Is the state a better pimp?
We think it's a better pimp, right? She concludes that, right? Okay. But you know, there's, you know, it has its drawbacks and stuff too, right? I mean, she's not written a book about, you know, the liberating effects of prostitution. far from it. It's a workaday world, right? And it's an interesting finding, I think, she has. Not one of her subjects tells a story about how they were pushed into prostitution or how they were forced into prostitution and so on. They all tell similar enough stories. Their experience with working in a maquila, mm-hmm, was onerous and abusive, mm-hmm, and made very little money and left very little time for these women to be with their children. Mm-hmm. Prostitution in a controlled environment was safer, or they said that they experienced it as safer.
I'll say this much to that
and
point.
Paid more.
I'll say this much to that point about safety. I've never seen in public, right, rude treatment of the women, because they're just everywhere.
Right.
And
right.
I've never seen, of course, any kind of fights at all.
Well, that's, yeah.
So there is something to be said.
There's an argument, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I spent like a couple of hours chatting with one of the women that I had seen working street corners in the Zona Rosa, because the Zona Rosa is, you know, a multi-purpose environment. It is the gay zone, but it's also, you know, heterosexual table dancers and prostitution and so on. So I spent a couple of hours chatting with a woman that I had seen over decades. And so here she was. She was probably in her maybe early 50s, maybe late 40s, early 50s. She was, she was very well put together. She kept herself in good shape. She did not look her age. She wasn't a, you know, all right, as they say, she wasn't a spring chick either. And we talked about her working. We talked about her working life, and you know, we had an interesting conversation. And she said a lot of her clients didn't actually want sex; they just wanted someone to talk to. Like what
I've
we
heard
what
that. I've
we heard were that. Standing there on the street corner.
I've heard, dude. I've dude. I won't get too far much into it, but a buddy who does hang out there, we were out there and he introduced me to this woman, US money,
right?
Five figures a month, because dudes just want to talk.
Right. Yeah, no, I believe this. And she, you know, her main complaint was that some of her clients were rude, you know, and that was like, you know, again, she talked about how this had innate, this life that most people would view as disreputable and pitiable, had given her time to spend with her daughter growing up. It paid the bills. It didn't pay them extravagantly for her, but it kept her. Now, all right, I haven't seen her for a while. I think she's probably had to retire. I also asked her about police harassment because, you know, that could happen. The Zona Rosa is kind of ambiguous. It's like things are usually tolerated. And she says, you know, the cops will hassle the younger girls out here. Like, they don't like to see a whole lot of us hanging out. But, like, I'm old enough to be their mother, and they leave me alone. They leave me alone, basically. I mean, again, here's an interesting project for someone, like the life of, you know, just the life of a streetwalking woman. I mean, what's it like? What's it go? What are the contours of it? How do they think about their experiences?
Roger Lancaster, thank you for spending the time with me and the audience today. Wherever you are watching or listening to the show, there are links in the description to the book, The Struggle to Be Gay in Mexico, for example. I hope you had a good time.
I had a great time, Jason. Let's do it again.
I tell your friends that the dude from This Is Revolution is an easy interview. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you, Jason.
We got to have you back on. Have a good rest of your day. That was Roger Lancaster, professor at George Mason University and author of his latest book. It's out now, The Struggle to Be Gay in Mexico, for example. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. I was up all night and early this morning reading the book. I didn't have time to read it until yesterday. And preparing some of these talking points. So I hope you guys had a good time. Leave comments on what you think about the struggle to be gay, where you're from. We'd love to hear it. Love to see it. We'll be back Tuesday with an equally depressing show, The Commodification of Loneliness. The whole gang will be here for that one. And we'll all tell our depressing life stories. You can understand why all of us are single after that one. It's going to be a good one. Definitely understand why I'm single. So on that note, thank you guys. Enjoy your weekends. Thank you again for joining us for movie night. That was so much fun. It's a community we have here, and I really dig it. I really dig it, dig it, dig it, dig it. So on that, let's go out with some fun music. Peace.